Radio Tonic.
Tonic.
Like lots of people, there's nothing I love more than sitting down on the weekends with a cuppa and the crossword. Recently, I've tried taking up the cryptic.
Ah, there it is, the crossword.
Cryptic crosswords don't have straightforward clues like basic crosswords. Every clue has a bit of wordplay.
Three down, kind of alias. 16 across, pretend.
Pseudonym P. You would think having two paths to the answer would make the puzzle easier.
14 down. The right sort of woman to start a dame school.
In fact, it's harder because you don't know which part of the clue is the straightforward part and which is the wordplay.
The right sort of woman.
Like lots of people, I'm often completely stumped by some of the clues. Luckily, help is on hand.
I love solving crossword clues, so hit me. My name is Will Shortz. I'm the crossword editor of the New York Times, puzzle master on National Public Radio in the United States, and I have the world's only college degree in enigmatology, the study of puzzles.
Well, look, I'm having a real problem trying to solve this crossword clue. Can you help me? It's 14 down. It's three letters. The clue is the right sort of woman to start a dame school.
If we help you with this clue, will you shut up?
17 across, three letters.
16 across, five letters.
I'm rather good at crosswords. Trouble is, I make them too easy.
The world's first crossword appeared in the New York World, which was an old newspaper, appeared in 1913. Those early puzzles were all straightforward, where every answer was a single word in the dictionary, and the clue was the dictionary definition. So if the answer was tree, the clue was almost always woody plant. They started adding wordplay to the clues. Over time, a whole body of rules developed for what we now call cryptic crosswords. The most basic type, I guess, is anagram.
Radio con it.
Rearrange the letters of something in the clue to get the answer. Another would be a homophone. The two words sound the same, but they're spelled differently. Another kind is dropping a letter. There might be a hidden word. The English language seems to be made for creating cryptic crosswords. Spelling and sound in English don't always coincide. Lots of words in English have two different meanings, like bark can be the sound of a dog. It can also be the covering for a tree. We can hide the part of speech in English in the subtext, in the cryptic sense.
It's one of the things I love about writing. Using metaphors and similes and ambiguity to say one thing and mean another. But why all the doublespeak?
Well, there's lots of reasons why we say one thing and mean something else. In the ways we interact, we don't always use the literal meanings for things. My name is Chi Lu. I'm a computational linguist and I've worked on dictionaries and multilingual search engines. And I write a language column called Lingua Obscura. Computational linguistics can be described as the intersection of linguistics, which is study or the science of language and language structure, and computer science. We often think of metaphor as something that we use in an elevated way in literary language. Like there are these two things, literary language and everyday language. But it's everywhere in language. And so you end up using metaphor to convey part of your human experience to someone else, to sort of express additional information. We simply can't use language literally all the time because even the things that we think are the most basic and most literal of words are really kind of a short form for something else.
Ada Lovelace, de son nom complet Augusta Ada King, comtesse de Lovelace.
In a way, all language is a kind of code, isn't it? And you have to know the word, the language I'm speaking, to know what I mean.
We've probably had secret messages for as long as we've had secrets to keep. The Spartans from ancient Greece used to send messages in secret. So we've had them for thousands of years. My name's Dr. James Grime. I am a mathematician and I currently run the Enigma Project, which is an educational outreach program all about the history and mathematics of code breaking.
Cryptography, from which the cryptic crossword gets its name, is the science of writing and solving codes, derived from the Greek words for secret and hiding. In fact, the earliest form of cryptography was writing itself. When most people couldn't read, it was easy to keep secrets, simply by writing them.
One of the famous examples of code making is a code that Julius Caesar used to use himself. Julius Caesar, being a soldier or a general, would have to send secret messages. So what he used to do is he would write out the alphabet and then he would shift the letters across. So one example is to shift the letters, say, 14 letters across. For example, here's a secret message. F-O-R-W-C-H C-B-W-Q. In that case, an F would become an R, and I could send a secret message using this idea.
Oh, sorry, James. I was just trying to work it out. So, what is the difference between a code and a cipher?
A code turns a message into maybe another message or word. For example, you might take a sentence like attack at dawn, and you turn that into eagle. That would be a code. A cipher works differently. A cipher works on the level of individual letters. So you turn one letter of the message into a different letter, or into a shape, or into a number. So each letter of your message gets changed. Not all codes are secret codes. Some codes are used for communication, such as Morse code. Morse code turns letters into dots and dashes. Now, the idea there is not to turn it into a secret message, but to help you transmit the message over a great distance by radio. And today, we use wireless technology, wireless internet, to transmit messages from our computers to the internet and across the world. And those messages are sent in binary or encoded messages in the same way.
We're in a Black Thunder, rolling down to Hampden Park Public School.
We're going to meet some kids from Code Club. It's a club designed to teach young kids how to code or program computers. Hi, Kelly.
Hi.
Hi, Sunil. Nice to meet you.
Through coding, kids can learn how to problem solve open-ended problems.
We needed to do point towards.
Yes.
These could be problems like cure for cancer, or how to stop traffic from ever happening in an urban environment. These are problems that Australians really need an answer to. We really need to see these problems solved one day.
And then you have to build the same script for each one, which would be move 10 steps and forever.
I'm Kelly Tagalan, National Program Manager for Code Club Australia. In order for human beings to interact with technology and basically give it commands, there needs to be a medium for conversing. And what we have is coding, or computer programming, is that language.
So why do we call computer programming coding?
Computer programming is called coding, I think, because it's been colloquialized, right? So the act of actually computer programming is known as coding. And I think it's because there are the people on the inside that understand the language, and then there are people on the outside that experience the language, don't understand. When they look at it, it looks like a secret code.
It sure sounds like another language. Or a secret code.
Language is like code in several ways. It's compositional, so you can break language down into units. Language can be seen as an algorithmic code of communication to share information. But code is really the process by which you convey information from one point to another point.
What's an algorithm?
An algorithm is really just a recipe for doing something. So you want to get from one point to another point, and you need some information to get from that point to another point.
My name is Aruba. I'm 11.
What do you like about Code Club?
I like how English and coding is the same. So if it says in Code Club, move 10 steps, the boy just moves 10 steps closer to the door.
The kids all love making games. So I got them to show me how.
If touching apple, then broadcast touch. Change score by 400.
When... So it's like a life cycle.
2,400.
When I should receive message one.
Yeah. So every time you make a message.
Very few people actually know that the first coder was a woman, Ada Lovelace. She was a contemporary of Charles Babbage, the mathematician, philosopher, and inventor of the first computer science learning machine in 19th century London. And they together created the first, what we would have called, computer code.
Ah, here we are. Augusta Ada King, Countess of Lovelace, English mathematician and writer, born 10th of December 1815. When Ada first saw Babbage's analytical machine, which was basically the first ever computer invented in the world, she was so fascinated by it, she wrote notes on it. And in the notes, she included the first algorithm or computer program ever intended to be carried out by a machine. Her mother, Isabella, was herself a really brilliant mathematician. And Isabella immersed Ada in the study of maths and science and forbade her from studying any poetry at all in case she turned out like her former husband, Ada's father, the infamous romantic poet, Lord Byron. Ada was as fascinated by poetry as she was obsessed by mathematics, and she wrote to her mother once defiantly, "You will not concede me philosophical poetry. Invert the order. Will you give me poetical philosophy? Poetical science?" Ada saw in that poetical science the way that maths was a kind of language, combining logic and imagination.
When I was learning about Shakespearean literature and I learned about iambic pentameter and how all of the language was timed according to maths, then I start learning about poetic science. My brain starts lighting up. When I think about kids and coding, and I think about their ability to take something that's strictly in their imagination, and they're able to put that into computer code and make it an experience others can have, that's when science for me becomes very poetic.
If a cryptic crossword setter makes crosswords that are hard enough to challenge puzzle solvers, but not so hard that nobody can solve them, and a code maker makes codes that are too hard for code breakers to break, how do poets use codes like metaphors and similes to make their readers understand what they're trying to say and reveal even deeper meaning?
A lot of poetry uses new metaphor. When you have a metaphor that's very conventional, everybody understands it. In poetry, if you come up with a brand new metaphor, the brain has to understand it. And I think the trick is not going too far.
If we don't know what a poem means, does it mean it isn't a poem anymore?
The thing is that poetry is about the message. In poetry, the meaning is not necessarily the crucial element. I think when people say, how is poetry like code or how is code like poetry, it's this romantic idea of there are certain attributes that poetry has, like elegance and succinctness. And in a certain sense, yes, code is like poetry because it can have a structure that looks like poetry. But the syntax is very strict in code. It has to be able to execute. Poetry does not. Poetry can essentially take its bones, separate them into component parts, and move them around a little bit. And within that context, it can still be considered poetry. But if you move a curly brace from one place to another in code, then your code is broken. It's not code anymore. Code ultimately has to make sense. Poetry does not need to.
Whenever you browse online securely, you're using encryption. Whenever you're doing a secure transaction, you're using encryption. Our economy now depends on encryption. My name is Daniel Matthews. I'm a mathematician. I'm a lecturer at Monash University. I was also a founding member of WikiLeaks. Classically, cryptography was about encrypting and decrypting messages and using ingenious ways to do this. Modern cryptography is different in several ways. So one way is that it's not just now about encrypting and decrypting messages, it's about the messenger as well. So maintaining anonymity, authenticating the person that's doing the communicating. Another way it's different is that it's been totally democratized. So whereas historically cryptography was either something that you did for fun as a puzzle or something used primarily by military or intelligence, today it's used everywhere.
And many people are now using modern encryption technology to protect their privacy and avoid being tracked by corporations, which mine our data for commercial purposes, or by governments, which monitor and retain it for security purposes.
If you are a human rights activist in an authoritarian country, you might well want to avoid being tracked by the government. People who just want to assert their right to privacy, they don't like the fact that they're being mass surveilled. And there are other reasons as well. Pirating videos, pirating movies.
Illegal download.
You wish to confess?
Me? No.
No. No way. No.
So now, instead of hiding the message, people hide themselves, or at least their computers.
On the internet, each computer, roughly, has an address. And that address is called an IP address. It consists of a series of numbers. And that's basically what's used to locate that computer on the internet. Say a number like
203.2.218.214.
You can just type that into your web browser, and then your web browser will find that website and it will actually show you the domain name.
And to hide even further, many people go to very deep, very dark places indeed.
The deep web and the dark web, things relating to the parts of the internet that are not so easy to see or not so easy to access. And there are sort of two separate concepts here. So what I would call the deep web simply refers to things that you can't access via search engines, via Google. And that's about 99% of the internet.
Things like bank files, government or military servers, corporate intranets, hospital records, stuff like that.
On the other hand is the dark web.
This is all those shadowy parts of the internet you can't get to without knowing the secret address or using specialist software.
You've got things like drugs, you've got markets for all sorts of objects, you've got whistleblowing websites, you've got websites about cryptocurrency like Bitcoin, you've got websites about anonymity, you've got forums, you've got chat sites, and you've also got things like child porn as well. So it's quite a mix of things and quite a range of social acceptability and legality.
On the 5th of January 2012, an intriguing and mysterious message appeared in the depths of the dark web.
It wasn't announced, there was no fanfare, it just appeared quietly on a message board on the notorious 4chan website.
Hello.
It was a simple black square, and the message on it read, "We are looking for highly intelligent individuals. To find them, we have devised a test. There is a message hidden in this image. Find it, and it will lead you on the road to finding us." Cicada 3301 is simply what you make of it. It could be a brain teaser, Sudoku that lasts you a few minutes. It could be a scavenger hunt that consumes your life for months and months. It could be a community where you simply meet other people trying to solve these problems. Or it could be something more sinister. My name's Chris Bell. I'm a writer, a screenwriter, and an avid fan of complicated puzzles. I first wrote about Cicada 3301 back in November 2013. Part of the delight, I think, that a lot of people find with Cicada 3301 is this huge variety of clues and puzzles that need to be solved.
The Gripper, a poem by William Gibson.
MC Escher, Ed Voss Cypress, The Caesar Cypher, Prime Numbers, Magic Squares, RSA Encryption. RSA encryption.
These are the most fiendishly difficult problems that have, I think, ever been set on Earth. We don't know who's doing them, we don't know why, and we don't know for what purpose and to what end.
appearing every January 5th until 2014, because according to some Circadians, the 6th is the Feast of Epiphany. Cicada 3301 has left enigmatic and mysterious riddles across the dark web and the world, with clues appearing as far apart as Seoul, Moscow, Mexico City, Paris, LA, and Erskineville.
There is a code that underpins all Cicada puzzles. Prime numbers appear a lot. Both parts of the name Cicada 3301A are central to the puzzles you'll find in it. 3301 is a prime number which features regularly. Cicada, the insect, appears in imagery, in references, even in sounds throughout the puzzles. The cicada insect appears only every 13 or 17 years, prime number years. So the insect itself is key. A lot of the puzzles with cicada require an enormous amount of collaboration, and this is why I think they've been so popular.
Cicada 3301 has spawned a slew of collaborative puzzle-solving websites.
I think the amount of people who've solved cicada in the world is a handful. I think it's maybe two dozen, but certainly no more.
And it's hatched a swarm of conspiracy theories.
Apparently, those people since have been made to do personality tests and solve individual puzzles themselves, but none have revealed exactly what they've been asked to do or why they've been asked to do, or indeed what the organisation behind Cicada 3301 is all about. There could be any reason for this. They might be dead. They might be whisked away by some nefarious sort of new organisation, sort of quasi-military organisation, to be part of an enormous hacker group. Or they might just be in on the joke. Obviously, this makes the security agencies like the NSA, CIA, MI6 front and centre. They're always the kind of pantomime rogues that get roped into these things. And indeed, there is a lot of evidence that suggests they're using these kind of online tests for recruitment. Technology's enhanced both the puzzle making and the puzzle solving, I think, considerably. I mean, back in, you know, days of World War II when people were setting cryptoanalytic problems like this, it was all done on crosswords and cryptocrosswords.
You finished?
Yes.
In the film The Imitation Game about British codebreakers during World War II, there was a scene where they were recruited by the brilliant mathematician Alan Turing with a cryptic crossword.
5 minutes and 34 seconds.
You said to do it in under six.
There is some truth to that story, but not exactly how it was presented in the film. There was a crossword competition. The crossword competition was set by the Telegraph newspaper to see if anyone could solve it in under 12 minutes. Apparently about 30 people attended this competition, and four people actually succeeded and did solve the problem in under 12 minutes. I believe the winning time was 7 minutes and 58 seconds. So today you might expect that we don't need these kinds of people anymore, now that we have fantastic computers that can search a great number of keys for codes. In fact, those computers can only do what we teach them to do. So it is a battle of wits between two human minds, thus the code breaker and the code maker. A computer can only search faster than a human can, but it can't think like a human.
I think we start solving a puzzle logically, and if we get stuck, then we start making leaps of imagination. That's where good puzzle solvers come to the fore.
So why do we like puzzles so much?
I think solving puzzles is in our DNA. We like to solve problems. Most puzzles and problems we face in everyday life don't have clear-cut solutions, and we're not completely in charge of our lives. With a human-made puzzle, you are completely in charge yourself. That's a great feeling of empowerment.
There was a girl in Hobart. She turned to me and she said, "I like coding my own games because I make the rules." So she'd been playing a game she really enjoyed on her iPad, but she got frustrated because there's only certain things that Barbie would be allowed to do. And so she wanted the heroine of her game to be able to do more and think more and solve problems. You know what the heroine of her game does? Helps the polar bears find directions to new ice caps so that they don't starve. This is a real-world problem she's solving in a game that she's come up with herself.
That reminds me. That cryptic crossword clue.
The right sort of woman to start a dame school.
Three letters. Well, the answer is Ada. And there's two paths to the answer. First, the straight part is the right sort of woman, because Ada is a woman's name. And it literally starts a dame school. It's the first three letters there, a dame. A-D-A.
So it all comes back to Ada. Or is that Cicada?
An Easter egg. An Easter egg is how computer programmers show off. It's a little secret. It's a little joke, a little game, a little nugget kind of hidden in computer code, using technology to kind of reveal something unexpected.
In the same way, I suppose, poetry does with metaphor and analogy, simile and symbolism, to reveal deeper meanings. Or radio does with secret sounds.
Riddle, Mystery, Enigma was written and co-produced by Sunil Badami, with sound by Stephen Tilley. And for the puzzle lovers and code breakers playing along at home, did you catch the clues? Hidden in today's program were four puzzles. Solve them, then head to the Radiotonic homepage and click on Riddle, Mystery, Enigma. Enter your answers and discover if you've found our own Easter egg. If you missed them, don't worry. You can listen back, crack the code, and leave us a comment online. abc.net.au/rn/radiotonic. You can also share your sleuthing with us on Facebook. Search for RN Creative Audio or on Twitter at @RN_CAU. I'm Jesse Cox. Join me again next time.